Welcome to American Indian and Alaska Native Living, a program designed to educate and inspire listeners throughout Indian country. American Indian and Alaska Native Living is hosted by Dr. David DeRose, a board-certified specialist in both internal medicine and preventive medicine. Dr. DeRose has a wide range of experience with Native health issues, and he is here today to help you learn more about your health. Here is Dr. DeRose.
Welcome to American Indian and Alaska Native Living. I'm Dr. David DeRose. Today we're taking a deeper dive into a subject that we've touched on actually a number of times over the last month or two, if you're a regular listener. We're speaking about the microbiome. If that's a strange term to you, if you're just jumping on for the first time, we'll get it defined here shortly. But before we do that, I want to introduce you to our guest who is an expert on the topic, Dr. Pekka Matinen. Dr. Matinen, it's great to have you with us today.
Great to be here. I appreciate you inviting me on the show.
You know, from the very outset, I have challenges seeing all those vowels and double consonants in your name. So let us hear the correct Finnish pronunciation of your name.
It's Pekka Matinen.
Okay. So my listeners have heard it correctly once, and I'll do my best to try to replicate that, Pekka. And it's spelled P-E-K-K-A, your first name, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So your family obviously has roots in Finland, but my understanding is you were born in North America. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yep, in Ontario.
Okay. Well, we want to get a little idea, first of all, of who you are. So we know you've got roots in the Scandinavian countries, born here in Canada. And right now, you're an associate professor at Burman University in, that's Alberta, isn't it, where Burman is located?
That's right. Yes, small town Lacombe, Alberta.
And this is not a typical trajectory for every person born in Canada. Tell us a little bit about that life path in short order.
Okay, well, I'll give you the quick version. Basically, I got very fascinated with living things when I was a child, and so I dug into that later in university. I did actually a cell and molecular biology specialist program at University of Toronto, and then I went to McGill and did a PhD in biochemistry, so that's in Montreal, Quebec. And then after that, I got drawn to the prairies by my wife to the University of Saskatchewan, where I did a postdoc looking at actually vaccine development for mad cow disease, which is an interesting area.
Oh my.
That's where I sort of got introduced first to the microbiome. So in the same lab, there was a researcher studying a disease called Yoni's disease, which is in cows, caused by a bacterium called Mycobacterium avium paratuberculosis. So I studied that, and I got really fascinated by the interaction between the gut and those microbes specifically. And then I went and did a postdoc back in Toronto, had to go see my family again at SickKids on gut and diet, so in some animal models. And then finally, 2 years into that, then I got recruited out here to be a professor. So that's the short version.
Wow, it's a fascinating background. I did not realize all the areas of interest you've been involved with. I say of interest because a lot of these things I've been interested in over the years. So the microbiome, give us a quick definition of what that is. What are we talking about?
Yeah, so the microbiome really is any living thing in and on us that is not us. So, that's kind of a simplified definition, but you could call it the trillions of microorganisms, bacteria, archaea, viruses, fungi, protists, any other eukaryotes that are not us, found in and on the human body. The vast majority of them are in your gut. So about 95% of them are found in the gastrointestinal tract. Approximately 100 trillion cells, depending on who you ask. So there's many of them. It's actually incompletely charted. So, you know, when you ask me to say, what's the microbiome, I can't actually tell you because we don't even know all of the microbes. About 3,600 different species have been identified with high quality genomes. maybe 17% is still remaining. It's kind of dark matter, dark sequencing matter that we just don't yet have identified. So it's a pretty still growing and being clarified field.
So the microbiome, all organisms that really are connected with us on our skin, in our mouth, our nose, that whole, yeah, all those areas, but 95% of these microorganisms are in the gut. So we're often speaking specifically of the gut microbiome when we have these discussions. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, there's some stages when you first are born where microbes from places that are not necessarily the gut will be seeded into you. But that's essentially what we're talking about when we talk about the microbiome, and most people do. And really, when we say microbiome, just to kind of clear definitions, microbiome usually refers to the sequences or the genetic sequence, the biome being the genetic sequences representing those, and the biota are the actual living organisms. Of course, some of them are viruses, so they're technically not living organisms, but that's just kind of a, some people use those terms interchangeably, so we don't have to get too nitpicky about it, I suppose.
Okay. So let's kind of step back just a little bit, because you've got this interesting background, and some folks, you know, you mentioned mad cow disease in some of your training and your postdoc work. A lot of folks in Indian country have deep ties to wild game. And of course, you know, there's this disease, this chronic wasting disease that we see in, you know, deer and elk and things out west. And some folks may be wondering about that, and they're saying, wow, if you got an expert here, you got to at least ask him about this. Is it really the same disease process as causes mad cow disease?
Essentially, yes. However, the species barriers are real. So, for example, you may be aware that the way that mad cow disease arose was from the scrapie in sheep in the UK. These scrapie brains, if you will, of the sheep were being fed to up the protein content in the cow feed, and then the cows ended up getting bovine spongiform encephalopathy, which is BSE or mad cow disease. That barrier seems to exist between sheep and humans. If we eat sheep that are infected, we don't seem to get the disease. So it has to kind of go to the cow, and then from the cow can come to the human. In the sense of it, when you talk about CWD, which is the form in deer and elk, there are some accounts of passage of that disease to people. It's not, I would say, it's probably not as clear a path as from the cow to the person. Maybe that's because people don't eat as much of, you know, the deer in, typically. But there may be a little bit of a species barrier there just because of sequence differences in the proteins. So it's hard to do those experiments ethically to really demonstrate. But it does seem that it's possible. I think there were some hunters in Montana who had had some infected elk, and they were younger men. And then they did actually end up, unfortunately, getting a form of Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, or this human form, which is quite terrible.
It is. I've actually seen it clinically. So, I mean, yeah, it's nothing that you would want to sign up for. And you know, a lot of people say, well, okay, that X's brains off the list. No cow brains, no sheep brains. Although you said there's the barrier there, the species barrier, but no deer or elk brains. But it's not just the brains. It's the, basically there's nervous system tissue that courses through the muscle and all. Is that still the common thinking that you could get it from eating, you know, I mean, again, we're not talking about this, you know, huge epidemic with millions of people and millions of hunters getting it, but there is a concern. Is that legitimate?
Yeah, there's a concern, but most would argue in that field that if your muscle tissue is free from, we actually tested this in the lab, a specific marker for central nervous system. If it's free from that, the dosages would be so low that it would be highly unlikely that anything would occur. Again, you know, do we want to play with likelihoods? That's the challenge. And I think, you know, certainly it has been demonstrated that even in blood, there are several molecules of the prion protein. Now, that may sound like, you know, like a lot, but that's not a lot. It's very little. But it's there. And so do we want to be careful? I would say yes. I mean, the safest way is probably to avoid it entirely. But again, that may be difficult for some. So just, you know, keep in mind, stay away from the brains and any central nervous system tissue if you are consuming the stuff.
Well, let's use this as a springboard to talk about the microbiota and microbiome, because mm-hmm. it seems like there is a common denominator in that, you know, when I listen to people who are talking about trying to help us have the healthiest gut flora, they're often making similar recommendations about decreasing the consumption of animal products, whether it be wild game or conventionally raised livestock. First of all, is that a legitimate connection that's being made by many?
Yeah. So maybe we could take a step back, and I don't know how far back you want us to take a step, but...
Well, no, that's what we're going to need. I want to make sure I'm going in the right direction before we go all those steps back. So if we're on the right track, let's give us the background.
Definitely. We're on the right track. I think the important thing for us to think about is how is our microbiota established, right? Mm-hmm. What are the first steps? And so a lot of people don't realize, but mother's milk, human mother's milk, is actually laden with a significant quantity of non-digestible oligosaccharides. Now, this is going to sound a little, that's a long term, right? But think of it as fiber in the milk. So this is actually soluble fiber, because of course, when you think of milk, you don't think of it as a fibrous thing, mm-hmm. but milk does contain in it this soluble fiber. And these are actually quite complex. They're called, for short, HMOs, or human milk oligosaccharides. And when you're born, the very first thing that happens is that you sort of go through this birth canal, right? And that birth canal seeds you with various bacteria. And initially, your microbiota in your gut is kind of in flux, and it's going through quite a bit of variation and settling, if you will. It takes about 3 years for it to settle. But very early on, researchers back in actually the 1900s, well, 1900 exactly to be exact, they found that in the stools of babies, there would be these little Y-shaped bacteria called bifidos. They called them bifidos because they're bifurcated. They're kind of like, they look like little Y-shapes in under the microscope. And these bifidobacteria were found in especially the breastfed babies' stools. And so they noticed that, wow, what, you know, why is there so many of these? What's going on? And so they actually did some testing to see, and they found that the infants that were having high levels of these bifidos in their stools and breastfed, they were resistant to other infectious diseases in their gut. Mm. And so this was kind of the first step towards understanding the value of these good bacteria in the gut.
So if I'm hearing you right, a child who's got more of these bifidobacteria, maybe they're exposed to, say, rotavirus or, you know, some type of common cause of, you know, salmonella, campylobacter, different germs or viruses that cause diarrhea, they would be less likely to become infected with a similar dose?
Yes, exactly. They'd be less likely to get infected. And part of that might be due to something we call competitive exclusion, which is this idea that certain, if you have a well-established population of good bacteria in your gut, they will occupy the niche, if you will. They will take up the nutrients and so forth that a pathogen might need. And there's really no space for that bad bacterium to come in and invade. But it's not just that.
Well, I can tell there's more to the story, but we do have to take a short break here. I'm speaking with Dr. Pekka Matinen. He's a PhD doctor of biology at the university in Alberta, known as Berman University. We're going to be back with more speaking about the gut, the microbiome, things that make a difference for your own health. We're going to find it's a lot more than just preventing infectious illnesses when it comes to your intestines. Stay tuned. We've got a lot more coming up on today's edition of the show. I'm Dr. David DeRose.
Today's broadcast has been pre-recorded. However, if you have questions about today's show or would like further information, please reach out to us on the web at AIANL.org. That stands for American Indian Alaska Native Living. Again, AIANL.org. Or you can call us at 1-800-775-HOPE. That's 1-800-775-4673. We'll be right back after this.
We are strong, we are resilient, and we will get through this together. But these are stressful times, and it's important to also practice good self-care. It's normal to feel overwhelmed, anxious, or afraid, but there is hope. Reach out to someone, connect with your friends, stay in touch with your community, and know that you are not alone. Learn more at wearebroadcasters.com/hope. Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
When Jim died, I wondered if I would be able to keep the farm. Then I heard about the USDA's loan program for socially disadvantaged farmers and ranchers. It's for women and minorities who may be having trouble getting credit. Once I was approved, the USDA's Farm Service Agency helped me get the credit I needed. Now I don't have to sell, and I can pass the farm down to my kids the way Jim's dad passed it down to him. I know he'd like that.
Contact your local USDA Service Center or visit www.fsa.usda.gov.
Social Security is with you through life's journey from birth to retirement. As your life changes year to year, so do your needs. For over 80 years, Social Security has helped to meet your needs and is committed to improving access to the services that make a difference in your life. Today, you can verify your earnings, estimate your future benefits, apply for retirement, manage your benefits, and even change your address, all from the comfort of your home. Social Security's online services help put you in control with secure access to your information anytime, anywhere, allowing you to spend more time with family, friends, or simply just enjoying the day. Social Security, securing today and tomorrow. See what you can do online at socialsecurity.gov.
Produced at U.S. taxpayer expense.
You're listening to Dr. David DeRose on American Indian and Alaska Native Living. Your comments and questions are welcome. Call now at 1-800-775-HOPE. That's 1-800-775-4673. Here again is Dr. DeRose.
Welcome back to today's edition of the show. I'm Dr. David DeRose. My guest, Dr. Bekka Matinen. He is an associate professor of biology at Berman University. He's sharing with us insights from his own study and the research of others into the human microbiome, these DNA genetic sequences that go along with the organisms that live, especially in our gut and the influence it has on us. Bekka, if someone is just joining us, we were speaking about some of the important contributions that a baby gets from his or her mother going through the birth canal and then mother's milk with these human milk we call oligosaccharides. Oligosaccharides, as I recall, these are sugar unit related fibers. Is that a way to describe it for lay people?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they're usually a little bit shorter if they're soluble, somewhere in the 6 to 10, sort of maybe even less than that, 3 to 10 units of sugar long. But yeah, they essentially act as food for those good bacteria. So as we were touching on, these bifidobacteria that are the constituents of that baby stool that's healthy, those babies that are more resistant to different pathogens. So speaking of the human milk oligosaccharides, or these fibers found in milk, it turns out that these fibers actually don't just feed the good bacteria. So we did some studies back when I was at SickKids doing a postdoc there in Toronto, where we took the human milk sugars and we just put them, we layered them onto a layer of intestinal cells just in a petri dish, and we allowed those to incubate together and then added some pathogenic bacteria to the layer there. And what we were able to find, which a picture would show you even better, but normally those cells lining your gut, they're held really tightly together by something we call tight junctions. These are sort of like these sort of glue that holds the cells together and makes sure that things don't leak between them. You may have heard of leaky gut. Mm-hmm. So this is kind of the idea that the gut starts to break apart. And normally this pathogenic bacteria breaks apart those junctions and makes it easier for it to get in and leak in. But what we found with adding the fibers to the cells is that it actually protected the cells from this effect. So basically the bad bacteria were not able to break those junctions apart. They stayed intact. This was actually independent of any bacteria. We didn't add any bacteria there. It was just the fibers that we were adding. So it was kind of a fascinating thing. We found it both with the human milk oligosaccharides and with soluble fibers found in fiber-rich foods.
So soluble fibers and fiber-rich foods, we're pretty much talking now about plant sources of nutrition. Is that fair to say?
That is fair to say, yes. So if you think about it this way, as you're weaning, because I was mentioning that by about age 3, your microbiota starts to become stabilized. And so as you're weaning, you start to eat usually a little mixture of other foods with the mother's milk, and including some fiber-rich foods, which are exclusively from plant sources, is really important because it's going to start to provide that food for the good, healthy microbes to keep them going. On the flip side, unfortunately, if you're not having that fiber there, or if you're including foods that are protein-heavy like meats, those ones will actually be converted into some metabolites that are not so good. And I'll touch on the metabolites right away. I don't know if you want to have any other questions on that first or.
No. So basically, just to make sure we're all tracking here together, of course, we're not recommending that adults, you know, try to find human milk to keep their gut healthy. So the alternative that we've got, as well as the infant, as he's establishing or she's establishing her own gut flora, the microorganisms that live in the intestinal tract, is to eat more of these whole plant foods. And maybe before we talk specifically about some of these mechanisms a little bit more, the concept of fiber, I think maybe that's a little confusing because a lot of people have heard, well, fiber's indigestible, but now we're talking about how fiber may not give us calories per se, but it's nourishing other things in our gut and maybe even nourishing the cells of our gut. Is that safe to say?
Yeah. So there's, I would say, several mechanisms at play. So those, if you think about the fibers, and I'll actually define a couple terms here to help us. So prebiotics are the foods for the good bacteria. So this is like the soluble fiber, the human milk oligosaccharides, these are prebiotics. They provide the food for probiotics. So probiotics, you've probably heard of, most of you've heard of probiotics, maybe that you can find them in the grocery store, maybe you find them in your yogurt, that kind of thing. Prebiotics are the food for the probiotics. So basically, they would be a substrate selectively utilized by this host microorganism to confer some form of health benefit. Now, prebiotics have more than one mechanism of action. They may, as I said before, they could directly protect the intestinal barrier from damage from pathogens, or, and that seems to happen through a signaling pathway of some sort, which we won't go into too much detail on, but what they also do is they provide the food for those good bacteria. And in turn, those good bacteria actually convert the fiber into some pretty incredible molecules called short chain fatty acids, or SCFAs for short. A prominent one of those is butyrate. And butyrate has a multitude of benefits, but one is that it actually is an energy source for colon cells. So those cells lining your colon, they can use butyrate. So now we've essentially outsourced our metabolism to these microbes. They utilize the fiber, which we couldn't use. We weren't able to get energy from that fiber, right, as you said. But now that energy is available to us through these short chain fatty acids, which they produce. And they have a multitude of other beneficial effects as well.
Now, this is all fascinating stuff. We want to, I know I sidetracked you. You were wanting to talk about the meats and some of the metabolites, some of the breakdown products of digestion of meat and how that may influence the gut and the microbiome. Why don't you tell us some about that?
Yeah, I can touch on that. So while fibers are turned into the really good, healthy metabolites, unfortunately, meats, what happens with them is that certain bacteria will thrive more on the meats. And to put it really simplistically, if you feed microbes meats, they will turn those meats into metabolites that can actually be toxic to your gut. Some of them have been linked to liver and colon cancer. Deoxycholic acid is one of those. And so if you're consuming large quantities of meats and not fiber, this is unfortunate because then you can have higher levels of those toxic metabolites present in your gut, which is definitely not a healthy thing.
So the deoxycholic acid, that is one of the metabolites of the bile that we use to help digest fat. Is that correct?
Yeah, so we actually do have, what happens is you have these secondary bile salts that come down and they can be metabolized by the microbiota into these things. But you also have meats themselves. If you think about it, in the meat itself, it contains, you know, things like cholesterol. It contains things like, you know, the various animal proteins present within the meats, and they can be converted into these toxic metabolites. Paracrasol is another one. There's a number of different ones. I'll spare you all the specific details, but there was a study back in 2014, a Nature study, showing that if you switch a person from a plant-based diet to an animal-based diet, you see an uptick in these toxic metabolites, and it seems to be linked to increased expression of the genes involved in making those metabolites in those microbes.
So to try to make this all practical for the audience, we're basically saying tie into those indigenous roots, because many tribes ate lots of plant foods, whether it's corn, beans, squash, and we just go down the list. These are the real health-giving foods when it comes to this microbiome. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely, yes. The high-fiber foods. And another thing as an important note, which all of us could benefit from, is, you know, those soluble fibers are actually present inside the cells of the plants. So if you are consuming a plant, it's important to chew really well, right? Mm. Chew the plant well, because what that'll do is it'll help release those soluble fibers. Remember, there are types of fibers that are insoluble, things like cellulose. So that, just like, you know, you think of a celery stalk, right? That is going to pass through you. But then there's also within the cells, there's that juicy part. And within that, you have the soluble fibers that will have very beneficial effects. I want to touch on quickly, because I know the short chain fatty acids are important, and we'll talk about them a bit more in a minute.
Yeah, we want to definitely talk about those short chain fatty acids. It's a very fascinating topic. We're talking about things that can make a difference for you. We're going to talk about brain health. We're going to talk about other metabolic processes, diabetes, obesity. It's amazing the range of things that this microbiome is linked to. Dr. Mattinen is staying by, and I encourage you to do the same, because these are practical things that can make a difference for you and for those that you love. Stay tuned. I'm Dr. David DeRose. We'll be back with more right after this.
American Indian and Alaska Native Living will continue in a moment. If you have questions or comments about today's pre-recorded broadcast, please contact us on the web at aianl.org or call 1-800-775-HOPE. That's 1-800-775-4673.
A message from the National Police Association. It used to be that any able-bodied person would offer to assist a police officer in danger. Now, passersby are more likely to take a video. There's a better use for your phone when an officer's in trouble. Call 911. Tell the operator where you are and what you see. Then, start your video to provide evidence later. To learn more about how you can assist law enforcement, visit nationalpolice.org. That's nationalpolice.org.
Unlike other health concerns, mental illness is not always easy to see. Depression won't show up on an eye chart, and you can't measure it on your bathroom scale. Sorting out a mental health concern is not something to attempt on your own. You won't find a bipolar disorder by looking at a thermometer. Like many other health conditions, help for mental illness takes professional diagnosis and treatment. Anxiety won't just go away under a stick-on bandage. So the sooner you seek treatment, the better. If you or a loved one has a mental health concern, don't go it alone. Find out what to do. For 24-hour free and confidential information and treatment referral, call 1-800-662-HELP. Learn more at samhsa.gov/support. That's samhsa.gov/support.
Using meth taught me everything about freedom, only not like you think. It taught me how easy it is to lose your freedom. If you think meth is taking control of you, ask for help. You have the power to be truly free. I know. I'm Jan, and I'm free from meth.
If you or someone you know is struggling with meth, call 1-800-662-HELP for 24-hour free and confidential treatment referral. Learn more at samhsa.gov/meth.
You're listening to Dr. David DeRose on American Indian and Alaska Native Living. Your comments and questions are welcome. Call now at 1-800-775-HOPE. That's 1-800-775-4673. Here again is Dr. DeRose.
Welcome back to the second half of today's edition of American Indian and Alaska Native Living. I'm Dr. David DeRose. My guest, Dr. Pekka Matinen, he is sharing with us from Alberta, Canada. He's at Berman University, where he is an associate professor of biology, having done his PhD work. And well, Pekka, I know what you did your PhD in, but I don't think we ever shared with our listeners how rich your background is. I mean, I've had a lot of biology and medical teachers in my background. I don't think I had a single one who had their PhD in the discipline you had. Now, I did have some other professors who had PhDs in that discipline, but they didn't teach biology. So tell us a little bit about your background.
Yeah, so my PhD is in biochemistry. I actually got, you know, we talked about mad cow disease earlier. I got interested in protein folding because of that. So mad cow disease, as some of you may be aware, is linked to a misfolded protein. So this protein is a normal protein, but its shape has shifted and it's in the wrong shape. And so that really got me fascinated in how do proteins normally fold? What's the right way for them to fold? And so I went and did my dissertation on protein folding quality control. So we looked at, there are actually molecular chaperones that are involved in keeping these proteins folding properly. And we looked at how they fold. And interestingly, one of them actually ties in with some of the work that I've been discussing here on the effects of short chain fatty acids and specifically human milk oligosaccharides on our intestinal epithelial barriers. So maybe I could share that story if you'd like to hear.
Yeah, we want to go there. So just to give people the big picture, I know, and having lectured to lay audiences, we often talk about proteins being like trains of amino acids, these chains of these protein building blocks. But what I think sometimes gets lost on people is just the level of complex folding. It's not just a simple, you know, linear molecule. These are three-dimensional structures. Some of these huge chains of these amino acids that are in these complex folded patterns that give the protein its unique activities. So that's really what we're talking about, right? I mean, like if someone were to ask you, well, like, what's the average number of folds in a protein? And I think a lay person might say, you know, three or four. I mean, probably not even a fair question to ask, right?
Yeah. I think it's quite incredible just how many different types of folds exist. And in fact, what's unbelievable is that even to this date, we're still not very good. We have improved in predicting the shape of a protein from its primary amino acid sequence. So there's a lot of complexity there in how these proteins fold. And some of them are very complex. Some of them have, you know, their membrane spanning, like cystic fibrosis related protein. You know, the CFTR protein has a very complex fold. We studied some of the quality control involved with that protein. So there's a significant number of variables, I would say, and directions that protein folding can go wrong. So it's incredible that it goes right so often. But it's partly through the help of some of these molecular chaperones that are there in a specific part of the cell called the endoplasmic reticulum that's involved in that.
So I know it's a lot of technical stuff we're talking about, but for you listeners who it's been a while since you had biochemistry or maybe never had biochemistry, were these we're talking about quality control within the cell, how your body makes sure things turn out right. And I think a lot of my friends in Indian country and beyond, they'll say, well, that's just evidence there's a creator supervising this. And I run into other folks who want to use other explanations, and whatever you use, it's fascinating. And we don't want to get too far down that. We want to talk back about these short chain fatty acids. So just to kind of recap, make sure I've got this right, Dr. Matinen. So when we eat these fibers, we're eating plant foods that have these soluble fibers, they are broken down by certain bacteria in the colon, and they make, some of the byproducts that they make are these short-chain fatty acids. You mentioned one of them called butyrate. Have I got that pretty straight?
Yep. Yes, indeed. Yes. And butyrate is a beautiful thing. I call it the beauties of butyrate because really, so first of all, it acts as a food source for these good bacteria. So that's a big benefit. So it helps promote the growth of these good bacteria. And sorry, I'm going a step backwards. It acts as a food source for our colon cells. They have taken the fiber, right? And they've turned it into butyrate. So just to correct myself there. And then what's interesting about that butyrate, it doesn't just feed our colon cells. It also stimulates cytokines that prevent inflammation. So I know that's going to be a bit of a mouthful for some, but think about inflammation as being a kind of a general problem for many of us, especially in the gut. So if our gut is overactive and hyperactive and doing things like getting inflamed, you've probably all experienced some form of gastrointestinal upset. And in that, you're experiencing some inflammation. The butyrate actually helps tone that down through signaling to some cells we call T regulatory cells. They're basically the sort of slow down the immune system type of cell to say, hey, everything's okay. We're all good bacteria here. You don't need to overreact to us. So that's one big thing they do. There's a direct effect on expression of genes involved in inflammation. There's an upregulation, and this is where it ties in with our discussion of protein folding quality control. There's an upregulation of production of mucins. Now, mucins are a wonderful protein, very much coated with sugars as well, that come onto the surface of your intestinal epithelium. And you can think of it as a single layer of cells, but they form this thick barrier there, this thick layer that prevents invaders from coming in. And those mucins get upregulated by these short-chain fatty acids. So there's a signal that tells them to be upregulated that way.
So we're talking about these cytokines, these messengers that are involved with inflammation, and we want to tie some of this in to brain health. This connection that you and I have, it was actually orchestrated by my wife, who's a physician. Many of my listeners know she was at some scientific meetings out west. You were one of the invited speakers, and I know the focus for that whole conference was dealing especially with things that affect mental health, mental outlook. How does the gut microbiome tie in at all with brain health?
Yeah, it's a great question. So it really touches in a lot with this concept of inflammation and the fact that our gut is essentially our second brain. So we have a tremendous amount of nervous system attached to our gut. We call it the enteric nervous system. there's a whole cottage industry, if you will, of production of neurotransmitters that occurs in the gut. So some of you, if you've been in that gut brain area, or if you've heard about even the brain in general, you've heard of serotonin, which is an important neurotransmitter. Serotonin is actually a byproduct of tryptophan. Tryptophan being an important amino acid that can be converted into serotonin. Now, there's a large production of serotonin in the gut for use at the gut. So that's important. But that serotonin, unfortunately, doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier, so it doesn't have much of an effect mentally directly. However, the metabolism of tryptophan is definitely something that gets modulated. And so one thing that our gut can do to benefit our brain levels of serotonin is that it can prevent itself from metabolizing too much tryptophan. And I know this may seem a little bit of a story that's, you know, you have to piece together, but let me give it to you sort of in simple terms. So if you imagine tryptophan needs to be present in the brain in order for it to be converted into serotonin.
Right.
Well, if you use up all that tryptophan in the gut, you won't have as much to convert into serotonin in the brain. So those good bacteria found in your gut, the lactobacilli, the bifidobacteria, the fiber fermenting bacteria, they seem to actually turn down the overuse of tryptophan in two different pathways. I won't go into too much detail. One is the kynurenine pathway. The other one is the indole pathway. These two pathways, they will use up that tryptophan. But what ends up happening is if you have the right bacteria present, they turn down that process. So you get elevated levels of tryptophan, which then allows more tryptophan to be accessible to the brain. So that's one connection. The other one is, of course, through inflammation. So if you have less inflammation in the gut, you'll have less inflammation in the brain. And that's partly mediated through a type of immune cell found in the brain called microglia. So these microglia, they can be stimulated by pieces of bad bacteria to induce inflammation in the brain. And unfortunately, that could be linked to a number of different diseases, including depression and even some neurodegenerative diseases as well. So we're learning a lot more about the gut-brain connection, but that's just a couple of tidbits about that.
So Dr. Manton, if I'm hearing you correctly, are you saying that there's pieces of these bad bacteria in the gut that actually get into the bloodstream and then can get past the so-called blood-brain barrier into the brain?
So I would say that it's more of a stimulatory effect. So if you think of something like when your body experiences inflammation, these pieces of bacteria, they are part of the mediators of that. So we often think of it as the outside of a gram-negative cell, but essentially these pieces, they will come and they will turn up inflammation. And inflammation in one part of your body can influence inflammation in other parts. Mm-hmm. But it does seem from the data that we have now, because we do have a connection between the gut and the brain through a nerve we call the vagus nerve, and that's a really direct connection. So can there be signals passed through the vagus nerve? We do know that's the case as well. Mm-hmm. So inflammation we experience in the gut could induce inflammation in the brain. Whether the specific pieces of the bacteria are actually getting into the brain, that might be something that I'm not 100% I haven't done the study myself, but I imagine that it's possible.
Now, one of the things that I think will be interesting to my listeners, and I know you haven't completed the research and all the analysis and publication, but you've been looking at some indigenous Arctic berries. We have Native Alaskan listeners, we have listeners from Canada, northern parts of the U.S. Tell us a little bit about one of the berries that's captured your interest lately.
Yeah. So there's a berry that's been recently named the Haskap berry. I'm sure that it's actually much more, there are other terms for the berry. In fact, in Finland, it's called the Joulukka, the wild form of the berry. This berry is not particularly tasty in its wild form. It's quite sour. However, there have been some researchers in the University of Saskatchewan who've done some work on this berry, and they found that it's very high in anthocyanins and beneficial for our health because of that.
We definitely want to talk about the Hascap berry and some other things that relate to weight control. These will be coming up in our final segment of today's edition of the show. I'm Dr. David DeRose. Dr. Mattinen and I will be back for one final segment. Stay tuned for more. We'll be right back.
Today's broadcast has been pre-recorded. However, if you have questions about today's show or would like further information, please call 1-800-775-HOPE. That's 1-800-775-4673. We'll be right back after this.
If a natural disaster comes knocking, how prepared is your family? You can't just close the door on earthquakes, floods, or hurricanes and hope they go away. That's why it's important to make a plan now. Ready.gov/plan has the tools and tips you need to prepare your family for an emergency. So if disaster shows up at your doorstep, you'll be ready. Visit ready.gov/plan and make a plan today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
I'm just texting him back.
I'm just posting a story.
I'm just changing the song.
I'm just...
No. When it comes to distracted driving, just don't. Sending a text takes your eyes off the road for just 5 seconds, but in that time, your car can travel the length of an entire football field. Any distracted driving just isn't worth it.
Visit StopTextsStopWrecks.org. A message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, and the Ad Council.
What is a number story?
My number story started with fear and a lack of support, and it has led me to be there for others.
A number story begins in our childhood with ACEs, adverse childhood experiences.
My number story begins with the separation from my father and the emotional abandonment from my mother, and leads to me being a role model to not only myself, but those around me by becoming the person that wasn't there for me.
ACEs are so common, 2/3 of us have one.
My number story begins with drug abuse and homelessness, and leads to realizing that I can live life by my own standards.
A study found the more ACEs, the more likely we may experience a host of serious health effects, physical and mental, but that doesn't need to be the case. Your ACE number is simply an entry point to your own story. Where it leads is up to you.
My number story begins with years of emotional abuse, and leads to peace, clarity, and security in my self-worth.
Take control of where your number story leads at numberstory.org.
You're listening to Dr. David DeRose on American Indian and Alaska Native Living. Your comments and questions are welcome. Call now at 1-800-775-HOPE. That's 1-800-775-4673. Here again is Dr. DeRose.
Welcome back for our final segment of today's edition of the broadcast. I'm Dr. David DeRose. Dr. Becca Mattinen, my guest, joining me from Alberta, Canada, or at least joining us from Berman University in Alberta, Canada. Of course, he is in Alberta, but that's a big place. If you're trying to place him on the map and you're just joining us, Dr. Mattinen, we've been speaking about a number of things tied to the health of the gut microbiome, microbiota, the organisms living in our intestinal tract. We've spoken about things that relate to mental health, things that relate to inflammation, infectious diseases in the gut. We want to touch on the topic of weight gain, because there's a lot of people saying that maybe the microbiome is an important contributor to whether we gain weight or lose weight or maintain. How would you address that issue in simple terms with a lay audience?
So one way to address that is really to consider, as we're taking in our food, the quantity of food is really an important part. And many of us say, well, we want to eat enough so that I feel full, right? Which is true. We all need to feel full. That's part of eating and feeling satiated. One beautiful thing about fiber, which also feeds the good bacteria, is that it's quite bulky. So it takes up space. So as we consume the fibers, they actually take up a significant amount of space, particularly the insoluble fibers, but also the soluble will have an effect. And that adds to that amount that causes our stretch receptors in our stomach to say, hey, I've eaten a good meal. And so then we actually get less caloric density for our nutrient buck, if you will. And we have a significant amount of good nutrition, but we don't overconsume so-called empty calories. So that's a major contributor to the benefits of having this high fiber diet. But it turns out that as we talked about inflammation, you know, one of the underlying issues related to metabolic disease in general is so-called metaflammation, or this idea that metabolically we have systemic sort of low-grade inflammation, constantly sort of stewing there. And that issue is very much dealt with through enhancing the barriers and having the good bacteria present in our gut. So just another sort of side note there, if we consider the mucus layers being thick and the bacteria present in our gut being the ones that like to eat fiber, instead of eating us, they eat the fiber. So mucus is made up largely of oligosaccharides as well, partially. And so those oligosaccharides can be a food source for so-called mucolytic bacteria. These bacteria will eat your mucus layers if you're not giving them enough food. Kind of a simplistic way of seeing it. So if you don't give them enough fiber to keep them happy, they're going to be, oh, well, maybe I'm going to eat you to kind of keep myself happy. And so then you end up thinning that layer and then you get more inflammation, which then feeds into this whole metabolic syndrome and obesity and metaflammation that we know is tied in with metabolic disease.
Fascinating stuff. And yet we want to bring it all down to the practical level. We've been touching a number of times on things that we want to eat more of. We want to, I mean, one of the takeaway messages I got is those infants should be getting mother's milk. Early on, they should be getting these plant fibers as we're introducing foods. And I heard that same message for humans. We should be eating more of those plant foods, less of the animal products, less of the meats and things like that. Can you help us with even more direction than that as far as try to help us have the best microbiome, if you will?
Yeah. So that's a great, great point. So there's been some pretty big studies on looking at what really enhances our diversity of our microbiome. And really, it's a diversity of foods. And diversity seems to tie in with less inflammation, seems to tie in with benefits holistically for our body. And so if we're consuming, just to give you a practical sort of thing you can take home and do, if you're consuming 30 different whole plant foods in a week, that's a great rule of thumb. Some studies done, there's the American Gut Project, and there's a group from King's College London who have done, Tim Spector, who did some work on this area. They did a massive study comparing, intakes of people and their microbiota. And they found large quantities of different foods, plant foods, gives the best benefit there. How much fiber total should you be eating? Probably about 40 grams is a good place to aim per day. I would say that's even a low estimate. I know that the recommendations are about 28 grams for women and 35 for men. 40 is something you can do. And if you go back to your indigenous roots, I would say people that were living pre sort of industrialized time, they would have been consuming possibly 100 or more grams a day of fiber. So don't feel like you can get way too much, although you should gradually work your way up and drink plenty of fluid as you consume more fiber.
Wow, this is fascinating. So 30 different whole plant foods. I mean, anything from a plant source counts? I mean, nuts, beans, fruits, vegetables, grains, all of that?
Yes. Now, I will give you some super soluble fiber foods. There's a few here. So if you want to get, there's two soluble fibers that are really popular out there, and don't get them in supplement form, get them in the food. So inulin is one of those, and the other is SC-FOS, or short chain fructooligosaccharides. Don't have to remember the name, but just think about the foods you can get them in. So onions, leeks, garlic, very high in these soluble fibers. Also, there's a food called the Jerusalem artichoke. There might be an indigenous term for that. I am not sure. But the Jerusalem artichoke does grow sort of in the wild, and it's very, very high in fiber. In fact, don't take too much too quickly because your body won't be used to it. So, you know, gradually work your way up with that, and you'll get lots of soluble fiber.
So inulin, I think that's a more familiar term, not insulin, but inulin.
Inulin,
and
yes.
Then what's the other term that you used?
SC-FOS, which is a short chain fructooligosaccharide.
And these short chain fructooligosaccharides, they are found in the same places you find inulin, or are they different?
Yeah, actually a lot of them are found also in those leeks and onions and garlic. But here's an area that, you know, you might say, well, why don't we know more about this? And actually, we don't know that much about all the fibers. It's highly complex. They're difficult to study. There's a group out of university, actually in Davis in California, making what they call the food glycopedia. So they're trying to define the different complex fibers. And this goes back to the complexity of the human mother's milk, sort of oligosaccharides. They're very complex. So the foods we eat should also be complex. The other very good source of fiber are legumes, beans. And some of those fibers are resistant starches. So these are a little bit different. They're not as soluble, if you will. They can be present in solution, but they're kind of a little bit more jelly and thick. They can actually be broken down successively by different microbes. So think of the ecosystem in your gut as breaking down these starch globules bit by bit, so that all along your colon, as it's passing through, you're getting a nice even coating of butyrate. So it's a wonderful way, and I'd love to show you a picture of it. There's a whole way that these bacteria break down these resistant starches found in beans, found in potatoes, found in some of these starchy vegetables as well.
Wow. Well, I know there's a lot more we could speak about, but in the very few minutes that we've got left, Dr. Natanan, we've been speaking so much about diet and the microbiome. I know you have a broader interest in lifestyle in general. Are there any other lifestyle factors beside the foods that we eat that can influence our gut and the organisms that live there?
Wow, that's a good last question to leave with. I would say just getting enough water. So when you're adding fiber to your diet, making sure that you're drinking adequate water. I don't say this just because of the benefit for the good bugs and so forth, but because water has actually been shown in some studies that hydration of the gut seems to act as a form of immune system that helps to clear things. So consider adding more fluid. You might think sunshine is actually not related to your gut, but that is not the case. So vitamin D levels are very important actually for maintaining a good intestinal barrier.
Wow.
So that seems to be important, getting enough sunshine.
Wow.
And then, yeah, I don't know if you wanted me to share. I know there's several other key things. Obviously, exercising gets your motility going. Lots of really good other things you can do.
Dr. Natanan, I would love to have you talk about a whole bunch of other things, but unfortunately, what always happens with this broadcast is the clock wins. And that's happened again today. Thank you, though, so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us and share with us some of the deeper things of the microbiome, as well as practical lessons that we can learn.
I've appreciated being here and enjoyed the time.
Well, for all of you that have taken time out of your schedule to join us to hear Dr. Natanan and me speak about these topics, I want to thank you for taking an interest in your own health and things that you can do practically. As always, I'm Dr. David DeRose, wishing you the very best of health.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.